And good afternoon and welcome into today's Community Comment. I am your host, Kevin Haugen. It is my pleasure to welcome into our Community Comment studio this afternoon our guest here on the program this afternoon, State Representative Mark Bourne. Mark, thank you so much for coming in this afternoon to talk with us.
Good to be with you as always.
And we're coming to you a little differently than normally scheduled due to a gaffe on my part. I gave the wrong time to the representative. So we are actually taping today's community comments. So this is essentially a replay from our conversation earlier in the day here today. So unfortunately, that means we will not be able to take any phone calls during the program today. But I feel like a lot of the phone calls that we would be getting would be centered mostly around the conversations that we're discussing here today. A lot of it with the budget process, recent action on the floor at the legislative level, just a couple bills that have worked their way through there. So we'll be discussing those throughout the program this afternoon. So apologies, no phone calls today. Next time Mark is on, I'm sure we'll we'll get to those phone calls and have the community be able to comment during our program today. But unfortunately, today we'll not be able to get to those. But again, want to thank our guests here today, State Representative Mark Bourne, for joining us here on Community Comments. And Mark, want to kick things off to discussing that budget process here. As obviously, just back in February, the governor gave his budget address. That essentially means that the document is out of his hands, goes into the Joint Finance Committee's hands, which you are co-chair of. But where we sit here today in about the closing in on the end of March here, where are we in this budget process?
Yeah, we are still relatively early in the legislative part of the budget process. As you said, we got it a little over a month ago now from the governor. And we have our Legislative Fiscal Bureau staff, nonpartisan staff, works for both the Republicans and the Democrats in the legislature in both houses, the Assembly and the Senate. They have done their analysis. We got that just a few days ago. So I have a giant binder that I will be thumbing through this weekend, reading all about what their findings were. And they really analyze it so in great detail so that we understand everything that the governor was doing in his budget, his executive budget, all the funding sources, you know, where the money comes from, that sort of stuff. And so that's the process we're in now, is still making sure we understand what he was trying to accomplish. And while we're doing that, then we are also in our information gathering, I guess you could say. So we're meeting with stakeholders, interest groups, things like that, but then also the general public, making sure that there are ways for everyone to weigh in. And as you know, and we've talked about it before on the program, I've been doing listening sessions throughout my district. So local folks here in the 37th Assembly District can weigh in. I think I've done 8 or 9 of those so far. Have another one today, actually happening right now as folks are listening to this. I'm in Mayville from noon to 1 today, so I'm sure I'm hearing a number of things from folks in Mayville right now. And other legislators, assembly reps and senators throughout the state are doing similar things in their districts, so that's part of the information gathering. We also have a web page that the Joint Finance Committee sets up that folks can go to and submit their thoughts, ideas, questions, whatever the case might be. And then the Joint Finance Committee does what we fondly call the roadshow, where we go out and have public hearings around the state. My Senate co-chair, Senator Mark Klein, and I announced earlier this week the 4 locations and dates for those events. The first one will be coming up on Wednesday, April 2nd. In Kaukauna, at the school, high school there in Kaukauna. That Friday, first Friday in April, we will be down at State Fair Park in the Milwaukee area. And then the next two are the last Monday and Tuesday. I don't remember specifically the dates, but it's the last Monday and Tuesday in April. And on Monday, we will be up in Hayward at the school district. And then on the Tuesday, we'll be in Wausau at the Technical College in the Wausau area. So that'll be the roadshow this year. And, we're there from 10 a.m. to at least 5. And folks come early. They line up. You got to register. And we call folks up in the order that they arrived. And everybody gets 2 minutes, unless you're a group. Then, which is actually a smart way for a lot of folks to do it. You see a lot of groups do this. Like AARP, for example, will show up at every one with about 15 people. They sit in the front row with their T-shirts, and then when they get called up as a group, they have one or two spokespeople, and we give them 5 minutes as a group then to kind of say what they need, and everybody can kind of line up behind them so they can show, you know, some support in the numbers, but they don't all have to sit there all day and each wait for their own 2 minutes to say similar things. They can kind of couple the message together in 5 minutes. And so that's been real effective over the years. I think a lot of groups do a good job with that, and it gets more people through then so that everyone doesn't have to have their 2 minutes, and you can get your message heard before the committee. So looking forward to that process. That's always it's always good to get out in the different parts of the state. It's always good to, you know, hear from folks. And those two components, the kind of studying the governor's budget and what's in it and what's not in it and how it works, and then the information gathering, whether it be in our local districts or the public hearings, those are the two things that are going on right now in the budget process. And that's the way it is. That's the normal process. So at this point, we're on schedule, and hopefully, if we remain on schedule in early May, we'll start the executive sessions that'll start crafting the legislative document that will ultimately be the budget that gets sent to the governor.
Just quickly going back to you mentioned the meetings for the Joint Finance Committee, the roadshow, mm-hmm. as you like to call it. Is that just to make sure I'm understanding correctly, do people have to register to be able to attend those meetings or register to speak at it? Is it free to open to the public? How do people find out how to get to yep. these meetings and be involved?
Yeah, they're open meetings to the public at all those locations. So if you just want to come listen, you can just come. There is no pre-registration. The registration to speak happens there. But if you want to speak, the lines form early. And then you fill out a slip with your information on it so that we know who you are and if you're representing yourself or an organization, there's a spot to put that on there and stuff. And then all of those get logged by time when those arrive by the staff that are handling that at the entrance. And then usually Senator Markline or I are in the chair, and then we call up people. There's usually a couple of microphones where lines form then, and we'll call up like 12 or 15 people at a time then based on when they arrived. They line up. Everybody gets their 2 minutes or their 5 minutes if it's a group. And then we'll call up another group of 15 or so, and they line up, and we move through. And so we keep it. It's pretty organized. We've been doing this for a while. Senator Merkley and myself for a while now, yeah. But also just the committee and the staff have been doing it for quite a while. And so we are able to move a lot of people through, hear from a lot of people. And there are also, as you kind of watch the crowd all day, there are people that just come to listen or to maybe support their friend who's speaking. So not everybody that comes speaks. We usually also, especially, we always try to be at a couple of schools, partly because it can get us into smaller communities. And a school gym or an auditorium is really the only place that's big enough for us.
Right, yeah.
So that just happens then because that's what works. But I like to make sure we schedule in a couple of schools because usually you'll see some of the classes come in and observe for a while. A lot of it's probably like the AP Gov classes and things like that, but you can see when it's their class period, all of a sudden there's three rows of students in the back of the auditorium watching, and kind of getting to see how some of the budget process and some of how our representative democracy works, can work, should work. So that's always nice to see too.
Yeah, and I also want to quickly go back to, you mentioned you've been holding your own budget listening sessions here throughout the 37th Assembly District here in our area, Dodge County, a bit of Fond du Lac County as well.
Yep.
What are some of the things that you've heard from the community here in our area that have piqued your interest or something that, I should take this back to Madison and share this with my members on the Joint Finance Committee? Is there anything that stood out to you during these last couple of budget session hearings that you've held yourself?
Yeah, I think there's certainly every budget, there's themes that develop. Some of them are always pretty consistent. There's always folks that are talking about education. I don't think that would be a surprise to anyone, especially in Dodge County and Fond du Lac County, I think seems to be trending the same way. There's always people that are worried about roads and bridges and local roads. So those are never a surprise. There is, now representing the city of Waupun, there's definitely a difference there where they're passionate about their prisons.
Yeah.
And that's not something that I've heard when I was representing the 39th Assembly District, mostly in Dodge County. Once in a while you would hear about, there was certainly well known that we had a staffing problem in our prisons. That's something that we addressed in a significant way last budget. That's a lot better now. Yeah. And so I would hear some of that in the Beaver Dam area and stuff, but not to the level that you do in the Waupun area. That was very noticeable to me last summer when I was campaigning there for the first time. Very noticeable now in the public hearing and having a listening session there. I think last Friday I was in Waupun. And so that was the only listening session of the ones I've done where there were people there specifically to talk about the prison and prison issues and stuff. And so that's one that's definitely a local nugget, I guess you could say. In some of the smaller communities, I hear more about the challenges for like their utilities. It's a challenge everywhere trying to meet the federal standards for like wastewater discharge and things like that. But when you're in a place like Beaver Dam where you have, I'm guessing they have thousands of users on their utility. If you're in a small village like Iron Ridge or Theresa or Brownsville, they may only have a couple hundred users on their utility, and you have to do really expensive upgrades for filtering and cleaning the wastewater. Well, if you can pass it among thousands of ratepayers versus 200 ratepayers, it makes quite a difference.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's been very challenging for communities, especially small communities, to meet some of these new nitrate standards and things in their wastewater discharge. And, there are clean water loans and things, but even a zero interest loan is still got to be paid back, and it's still super expensive. And so I've been hearing about some of those things for a few sessions now. That wasn't like brand new this time, but that's one of the things that is the differences between having a listening session in Beaver Dam versus having a listening session in Burnett. I think some people might wonder why I have so many or why I have so many so close together. I mean, to drive to the Burnett Town Hall from Beaver Dam, from parts of Beaver Dam, is like 3 or 4 minutes,
yeah.
Very close by. But I think there's two reasons that I have so many of them and have them in small areas as well, is because the first one being that diversity of issues, because you will hear about some different issues and that's important. But the second reason I do it is because I like being able to keep my listening sessions informal. You don't have to fill out a slip. You don't have to be called on. Because I have them all around in even these small towns and villages, because if 6 or 8 people show up, that's a great discussion group. But if I'm only having 1 or 2 in the big cities and I have to have 40 or 50 people then to hear from everyone, that still has value, but it's harder to just have a good discussion and make sure that everybody has a chance to talk. And if you have a big room, you're going to have some people that are more aggressive than others that are going to try to monopolize my time, and maybe some other people aren't going to get to speak. And then you have to go to the more structured things, like you see the congressmen have to do sometimes and stuff. And so I like to, not that I don't want to have a lot of people there, the more the merrier, but if you have more of them, you can keep that small, a little bit more informal. People get a chance to speak their mind and ask their questions. And so it's extra work, especially for my scheduler and stuff, to schedule that many. And, we certainly appreciate local media like you here at WBEV doing a nice job of letting folks know when those are and stuff. I think that helps get the word out as well. But it's been, I think they've been beneficial. They've been good. And I know that folks also appreciate them and because I just from last week in Waupun, that's a new area for me, and I had a couple of emails to the office then this week of, I was at your listening session in Waupun, I appreciated it, here's a follow-up question, whatever, thanks for doing this. And so it's been good.
We're with State Representative Mark Bourne here on Community Comment this afternoon. Now that you have had the chance to take in the budget, read through all the pages and examine it in closer detail, what items are especially interesting in you in the governor's capital budget?
And the capital budget came out here, I think, a little over a week ago. He's trying to do about $4 billion in capital investment. that's more than double the largest one in recent history. It's not a legit, it's not a realistic amount. There's no way the state's going to spend at that level. But I think there are a few things that we can find areas of agreement on, certainly. So we'll have to bring it down to a more reasonable amount. But he's doing more to invest in, it's called all agency, but what it really is routine maintenance. It's replacing a roof, updating an elevator, things like that. So that this is one that we've really tried to push the governor and the Department of Administration to do more of, because it seems like they always want to build a new building, right? The buildings get old, they're not modern anymore, but maybe if we can do more to keep it a little bit modern along the way, fix the elevators when it's time rather than waiting until too many of them aren't working, and you know, maintain the structures, we can save a lot of money in the long run and still keep buildings functioning in the way that they need to for the taxpayers. And so that's an important part, and I think we'll find some common ground there. We talked a little bit, I think, last time I was on about he's got a plan for reforming the prisons, for making some changes and closing Green Bay Correctional, which is our second oldest prison, and then modernizing some things at Waupun Correctional, which is our oldest prison, changing that from a maximum security to a medium security. And so there are some good parts of that. There are some things that need some work in that plan, so I think we'll probably make some changes. But I was very glad to see the Waupun Correctional part of that, because like I mentioned earlier, I certainly know the importance of the prisons to Waupun, to the community, to the folks there, to the history there. And so, but that's our oldest prison, and it's no secret that there's been some challenges there. It's hard to run as a maximum security prison because of its design and its age. We got a lot of folks there working really hard to do that, but there's certainly been some problems that have been, you know, well documented in both media coverage as well as criminal charges and FBI investigations and things like that. And so I think it's great that the governor finally recognized that we need to do something with our aging prison system. I think it's great that he recognized the importance of keeping Waupun Correctional in Waupun and functioning. And you know, hopefully we can figure out how to make that work. I think I met with the Department of Corrections Secretary yesterday in my office, and we both agreed that keeping Waupun in Waupun was important, and we both are hopeful that this project, you know, can breathe new life into Waupun Correctional. It's been a tough few years for them, just in the image of the facility. It's really tough for the staff that are working there, and sometimes some pretty difficult. I mean, those are always difficult places to work to begin with, but then when you have all these extra pressures of all the outside things, when you're short-staffed because of the inability to fill positions for a long time, it's been rough. And so hopefully this can be a new birth maybe for an old facility, and you know, move into the future as a place where we can help folks that are in custody and serving their time in prison, and you know, properly so, serving their time for committing crimes. But the fact is, most people do get out at some point. And so if that can be a place where we can help folks learn skills, work skills, that's going to be part of the focus of the new medium security facility there. And hopefully reduce recidivism then, as folks come out with some skills that can get them into the job market and hopefully get them onto better behavior and positive members of society.
Yeah, we have had recent conversations here with Dodge County Sheriff Dale Schmidt talking about just some of the staffing challenges when it comes to probation and parole side of of the State Department of Corrections system. And that's how you talked about last budget and how there was funds thrown in to help boost staffing at prisons to help that area. Is this something that you see as a thing that the Joint Finance Committee will be looking at here in the next couple of weeks? Is this something that's been on your radar to look at here when it comes to being able to help build or bolster the probation and parole staffing so they're not overwhelmed and struggling to keep up with the workload there?
Yeah, that's one of the things with you know, having to do the really what were massive increases for the state corrections because we had to right-size that situation. It was a really tough situation. But it did have an impact. It had an impact on county jails for the sheriff trying to staff their jails, had an impact at probation and parole, has had an impact in other parts of corrections. I was talking with the warden from the Burke Center a few weeks ago, and he said he even had a maintenance person decide to become a corrections officer because of how much the pay jump was. And, you know, they were already working in a prison. They were working as, you know, fixing things, you know, doing maintenance repair and that sort of thing. But right, they were like, hey, I think I could do that job. And that's a huge jump in pay for me and my family. And so you're even seeing, you know, some of those positions now that you have to rehire for that sort of stuff. So it's having an effect. And so we need to look at, that's one of the things I have my staff looking into is, I'm not saying that we're going to do increases in everything. We're going to analyze it. We're going to look at the market, you know, and what the vacancies are. If we're still staffing our food services pretty well and we're market pay, well, then that doesn't need an increase just because other completely different positions in the facility get paid more. That's not how it works. But if we're having trouble filling certain positions, if we're off on what the market rate is in a maintenance person or a teacher in the prison system or whatever, we are going to take a look at that.
As obviously, we are still here in just the month of March, and we're still months away from potentially a budget right. being signed by the governor. But in terms of where you see the timeline progressing here in the next couple of weeks, do you feel like that is a possibility to have a budget in adopted here at the end of this fiscal year, or mm-hmm. is it so hard to know where we sit today?
Well, it's always impossible to predict what's going to happen because every budget's different. And right now we are on schedule. I'm hopeful that we can stay on schedule, but I'm not going to pretend that there aren't some serious challenges along the way. There are challenges in every budget. There are some more difficult ones this time. We've got some issues with some lawsuits with the governor going on regarding his veto authority, and he's been trying to expand that. And so there's two cases in particular there that we're watching closely, and you know, expecting ruling on one of them any time now. The court's already heard oral arguments at the Supreme Court level because it could change the way we do some of this process. And so we kind of got to know that. So it's possible that things like that could hold up the budget process. I know some of my colleagues are saying that the budget's not going to be on time, or I've even heard some people say we're not going to do a budget. I think that is, to be a little blunt, kind of foolish at this point, because I don't know how you would know that. I mean, are all of those things possible? Of course they are. It's possible we'll be done on time. It's possible we won't accomplish one, period. I think not accomplishing one period is unlikely, but it's possible. And to know that in March is almost impossible. And this is from someone who has done, I mean, what am I on my fifth budget on the committee now? My third is co-chair. I'm very involved in the details of how this happens. And I can't tell you what's going to happen at this point any more than I could have in my first budget on the committee, which was the last budget under Governor Walker, when we got delayed and we didn't finish it until October. And I had this conversation with one of my colleagues yesterday that kind of wanted to debate with me that, oh, we're not going to get it done on time. And I'm like, well, how would we know that at this point? Because I can tell you with absolute certainty that in March of, that would have been what year, 19 maybe? Mm-hmm. 17.
Yep.
17. It's all blurring together. But so in March of 17, we had no idea that budget was going to end up being delayed, because we ended up having an impasse with the Senate on the transportation budget. And that didn't happen until June. And we didn't know that they had different feeling about it until June. So in March, the Senate didn't know, the Assembly didn't know, no one knew that in June, the whole thing was going to fall apart for 3 months on the transportation budget. Yeah. So if someone's telling you now that they know what's going to happen in June, I'm telling you, they're full of it, because that's not how this works. Like, there's now, do we know that there's some headwinds? Do we know there's some challenges? Do we know things like, I talked about, I think last time I was on the program, you know, our cost to continue, some of the inflationary costs of keeping just status quo, not adding new programs, but just doing the things that government does now, that cost to continue is really high. And we just got an updated memo. It's a little bit higher than even the last time I talked to you. It's up to about $2.4 billion now. And our ongoing revenue is less than that. That's what we would normally build a budget off of. It's about 1.8. So we have a deficit right now to figure out. Now, that's part of the process. We'll figure that out. But there's challenge. That's a challenge in crafting a budget. Then we've got the lawsuits I mentioned and trying to figure out how that changes the way or may not change the way we do things. And so that's a challenge. Just sometimes difference of opinion between the houses. That's what delayed it back in 19.
Yeah.
You know, and we don't know what those are yet. So that could happen. So it's a process. It works its way through. We usually figure it out. This is, like I said, my fifth budget. All of them except for that one, my fifth budget on the committee, all of them except for that one have been on time. So we've figured it out with some of these same or different or other challenges throughout. And so we'll let the process play out. And right now we are in, like I said, the two phases of figuring out what's in the governor's document and gathering input from the public and stakeholders. And you know, when we move out of that stage into the next stage, we'll address the challenges and the questions and the decision points that come to us. And is it a chance that, you know, we'll be delayed again? Sure. Is it a chance we'll get it done on time? Sure.
And
stay tuned.
I was just about to say that. I'm sure we will come back to this conversation in future programs. We will hopefully have a clearer picture by May, June, when Mark Bourne is back on Community Comment. And maybe that answer is a little bit easier to get to a couple of months. But as we sit here in March, it's still a long ways off before those things are
set. There's a lot of steps in that process.
A lot of steps yet to go here. And our guest here today on Community Comment, State Representative Mark Bourne. When we come back, we will take a deeper look at some recent action on the legislative floor, some bills that were up for discussion there. Don't go anywhere. More Community Comment is coming up next. And welcome back into our second segment today of Community Comment. Our guest on the program this afternoon, State Representative Mark Bourne, joining us on the program this afternoon. Again, I just want to note that due to a bit of a scheduling error on my part, we are pre-taping our conversation today with Mark Bourne. So this is not live, which means we cannot take phone calls today, unfortunately, as we are taping this program. But next month, when the State Representative back in our studios, we will be sure to open up those phone lines and get our listeners and viewers questions during that April show with our guest here again today, State Representative Mark Bourne. And Mark, want to spend here the second segment diving into some recent action that has taken place on the legislative floor here, some bills that were up for discussion, and there's a couple here that we want to highlight. I will let you sort of dive into it and sort of walk us through some of the ones that you want to note to our listeners, and what does that mean for our community here in Dodge County?
Yeah, so we've been three sessions of the assembly have met in the last 2 weeks. Last week's session was focused on public safety. There were a few bills that focused on some reckless driving issues. Thankfully, not as big an issue here in the 37th Assembly District, but a really big issue in bigger cities, especially in Milwaukee. And so we're trying to help, you know, clean up the roads a little bit there and bring some public safety to folks in bigger cities with some of that stuff. And then there was also some legislation on human trafficking, which continues to be an issue nationally, worldwide. I know there's some groups like Five Stones locally that do some good job of educating folks on that sort of thing. And so there wasn't any, massive major spending bills or anything like that. It was more things along the edges of trying to help in some of these areas that we see having an impact on our community. Then this week on the assembly floor twice, Tuesday was the State of the Tribes address, first of all. Yeah. That's something that's been done annually now for, I think it's pushing like 20 years maybe, we have 11 tribes, I believe it is, here in Wisconsin. They're their own sovereign nation. Their organization gets together, chooses one of them to deliver an address to the legislature every year, kind of update on what's going on with those partners here in Wisconsin. And so we had a few few minor legislative things that came out of a study committee that happens every 2 years with the tribal nations, of just tweaking things, kind of improving those relationships. So nothing huge there, but that action was taken up on Tuesday. The big bill on Tuesday that got all the discussion and all of the attention, I guess you could say, was a provision that was will require sheriffs for anyone that's brought into their jails arrested for a felony, so only for violent crimes, you have to be arrested for a felony, to confirm citizenship status. And if that person that was arrested for that felony is here illegally, then the sheriff's required to cooperate with ICE on that deportation process. And this is one that it was interesting to me how controversial this became. The governor, Evers, has been very clear that he's opposed to this, which is hard for a lot of people to understand, I think, because I think that the left just wants to make it part of the national debate on immigration and illegal immigration and their constant argument with Trump, and that's becoming some sort of like Trump derangement syndrome. But the fact is that this is very limited, and it's people that are committing felonies, violent crimes. And so why anyone, especially the governor of a state, would be defending someone who is here illegally to begin with, and to say that we should not participate in the federal immigration process with a person who has committed a violent act in our state. It's hard for a lot of people to understand. It's certainly hard for me to understand. It's something that should not be that controversial. It's something that in this area already happens. Sheriff Schmidt in Dodge County, I know when talking with Fond du Lac County recently, the sheriff there, they already work with the feds on this kind of stuff. So this is already done. This is nothing new will be occurring in this area. This is more focused on the counties like Dane County and Milwaukee County, where they don't work with our federal authorities, where they catch these people committing felonies, maybe get some convictions and get some time, and then they put them back out on our streets. And I don't understand why we would do that. So it doesn't. I understand that there's a big debate going on nationally about this now, and there's people that have a lot of opinions on that, and that's all well and good. That can and should be debated and discussed. But this is just saying, look, you're here illegally. You committed a violent crime in Wisconsin. We don't want you here anymore. Why would we not participate in that process to get you out of our state and the violence that you have brought to it? Seems like a no-brainer. But the governor has said he'll veto it. I don't know. It's in the Senate now. If they send it to him, we'll see what happens.
And a conversation we had briefly before coming on air today, and I think it's an important one to discuss here while we're discussing this particular bill that worked its way through the legislature. And it's an interesting side to this conversation, and that's the victims' families. Obviously, mm-hmm. A lot of times they want to see retribution or the criminal in this case get they want to see justice done for mm-hmm. the individual who was a victim of these crimes. And as I understand it, essentially they will not work their way through the criminal justice system here in the United States. If they are deemed to be here illegally, the deportation process would supersede that. Is that how I'm understanding that?
No, I don't think that's the case at all. Okay. I think that's entirely up to the local district attorneys that if they decide to charge it. I think now the way it works, the way it worked when I worked at Dodge County, which is getting to be a long time ago, was that they still got charged and went through the system. And then, you know, that's one of the things that gets debatable then is that the best way to do it? Because they might go into our prison system for a long time then and we'll be paying for them. And would it have been better to deport them? I think that's where you get into a whole different debate. So this bill doesn't speak to any of that. District attorneys can still charge, you know. The system can still convict. They can still go to prison. It would just be there would be the ICE hold then that would be waiting for them whenever, however many years they went to prison, if it's a couple years or if it's a lot more than that, would be waiting for them. And that's the way it used to work, because we would get folks at Dodge County then when I worked there that served their time in prison, came then out of prison back to our jail on an ICE hold that would go through the deportation process then. And so that's certainly one way to do it. And this bill doesn't speak to any of that kind of stuff. this bill just speaks to telling sheriffs, look, you have to work with the federal system on this. You cannot protect these criminals. And I understand that for most folks, including myself, they're already a criminal to begin with because they're here illegally. But there's levels, obviously, in our system. There's levels of crime. And that's why we're not looking to debate that level. We're not looking to debate misdemeanors, speeding tickets, things like that. We're just saying, look, the most violent folks here, why are we trying to keep them here? That makes no sense to most of us. And so that's really what this is about. And of course, the bill, I know there's some controversy because the bill would take money away from local governments that don't comply with the bill, that don't participate in this. And some people don't like that. And like, look, we believe this is a serious thing. And if sheriffs are not going to participate in this program, then there should be a penalty for that. And that's the way, that's why we wrote the bill the way we did. And, you know, I don't think most folks disagree with it because of the level of reasonableness with this. We understand that when you get down to different levels of the crime, people will have different feelings. I don't think most people think that murderers and rapists and carjackers and things like that should be protected from, you know, facing their day in the federal system and eventually being deported.
For sheriffs who, as you mentioned, there's a financial component to this that sheriffs who don't comply, it impacts the amount that they get in state funding. Is this something that essentially is monitored? How is that monitored? I'm just curious how the state would know, all right, the sheriff did not report this individual who committed a homicide into the federal agencies and work through that process. I was just curious if that's been set in stone yet, or is that still being figured out here?
I can't tell you specifically off the top of my head what the oversight function is in the bill, but there is a component of that in the bill.
Sure.
And also, these things are already, not that this would make it easy, but there are already public records of like who's incarcerated and things like that. So it could be found now, but there is a reporting requirement in the bill.
We're with State Representative Mark Bourne here on a community comment today. Just wants to quickly note that we are taping today's program, and so we will not be able to take any phone calls. So if you're calling in and you're not getting your phone call answered, that is why. But we also want to highlight another bill that worked its way just recently through the legislature dealing with Title IX.
Yeah. Yesterday, actually, we were on the assembly floor, and this is the second time in two consecutive sessions now that we've brought up some of these bills. And it's, it's Protecting Women's in Sports Act, I think, is what it's been, termed as. But it's another one of those things that is, sometimes I sit there in the legislature and think, how in the world did we end up as a society in a position where this is something that we're debating at a government level? And when you hear some of the things that are occurring, it's pretty shocking. You know, who thought it was okay to have a biological male in a sports locker room with 13 and 14-year-old girls? Like, at what point did society say that that was fine? It's troubling as a parent to hear that sort of thing. And so these bills are about protecting girls and young women, partly protecting them and their privacy and their safety when it comes to bathrooms and locker rooms, and then partly protecting them and their ability to compete in a fair way in athletics. I mean, Title IX is how you mentioned it leading into this. And, you know, so years ago, the federal government said, hey, we need to make sure that schools at both K-12 and then especially high school in that case, and then colleges are allowing for women a fair place and kind of an equal footing. You know, it's not just all about the big guys playing football. There are female athletes that are incredible athletes and incredible people and have the right to compete as well. And now it's almost weekly that you see somewhere that some biological male that says they're a woman now is breaking some state record somewhere in swimming or track and things like that. And, you know, most people wonder how we got there as a society. And this is another one of those issues, much like the violent immigration issue, where every poll I've ever seen, at the lowest, it's 70-some percent. Usually it's 80-some percent of folks agree, hey, no, biological males should not be in girls' bathrooms in high schools. hey, biological males should not be competing in women's sports. And it's about fairness. It's about protecting these girls and young ladies. And it's like I said, it's just surprising in a lot of ways as I sat and listened to the debate and to the Democrats defending this kind of behavior. It's concerning. It's clear that this is something we should be doing to protect young girls, young women. And there were other parts, there's other legislation too, but this is the one that I think gets a lot of the focus. But then there was also legislation to say, to make it illegal for doctors, pharmacies, to force drugs and, you know, actual surgeries on kids. It's clear, you know, things about brain development are some pretty clear science now. You know, we don't let kids make decisions on things like tattoos and alcohol and stuff, but we're going to allow a teenager to have surgeries that remove parts of their body and changes their life forever, or to take drugs, some of which aren't even FDA approved, that are, you know, puberty blockers and things that can change their body and their life forever. You know, it's one thing if adults want to do that kind of stuff, you know, that's to each their own, right? We can try as a society to respect people's wishes when they're adults and can make their own decisions, and people might think it's weird or it's not for them or whatever, but that's different. But when you're making these kind of changes to a child who can't fully understand these life-changing decisions that are being made, just partly because of the science, like their brains aren't developed enough yet. It doesn't mean that they're dumb or that they're wrong to be struggling with things in their life and mental health issues and things like that. There's also, certainly as a society, we should try to help manage those. But to say that it's okay to make these kind of life-changing decisions, this is another one where, again, if you look at the polling, the vast majority of people are like, wait a minute. Even if I think it's okay for adults to do that, like, we can't be doing these type of things to kids where they have no ability then to change their mind. Like, some of this stuff becomes permanent. Even some of the drugs change their bodies enough that it becomes fairly permanent, and or else the way to change it is really drastic and difficult. And so these things seem like common sense to the vast majority of people, but yet, you know, the Governor Evers has been out there saying, I'll veto any of these bills that end up on my desk. And as a parent, a lot of that's pretty concerning, and I think it is to a lot of folks. And that's why, you know, we spent a whole day yesterday in the state legislature talking about these issues. It's, to me, it's unfortunate that we have to spend that time. I'd rather be working on the state budget, talking about how we can invest in our priorities in Wisconsin, return some money to the taxpayers. And so it would be my preference that that kind of stuff never showed up in a government room. But I won't say that I don't support that it did, because it had to. Like, it had to. When we see this thing, it was, I think, Deerfield, Illinois recently, where, you know, a biological male was in the girls' shower with 13 or 14-year-old girls, I think. And it's like, no, come on. What are we doing here? This has got to stop.
My last question here for State Representative Mark Warren was going to be, do you believe the governor will veto or sign these bills? But I believe you've already made that pretty apparent where he's leaning towards on those two bills. But you know, maybe I'll shift gears here. And the last question I have for you, Mark, is speaking about the most recent bills that we talked about, is there for districts that don't comply, or for pharmacists who still will prescribe medications, is there an enforcement component to these bills that for those who still end up doing the things, if these end up getting signed into law, is there some sort of enforcement?
Yeah, I don't remember what the specific penalties are, but these are all making these things illegal, unlawful here in Wisconsin. So there would be, just like any other crime, some, I just don't remember how they're classified off the top of my head without having the bill in front of me right now. But those type of things would be criminal acts to protect kids.
And again, our guest here today on Community Comments, State Representative Mark Bourne. Again, we were pre-taped today, so unfortunately we weren't able to get to any phone calls during the program, but next time the representative is on, we'll be sure to get to those phone calls here today. But again, want to thank our guest, State Representative Mark Bourne, for joining us here on Community Comment today. Mark, thank you again so much for joining us.
Good to be here as always, and we'll see you next month.
Fantastic. And that will do it for today's Community Comment.